So you don't get too nervous. This one's going to be a little longer than usual, so remain calm. Don't panic after 11 minutes. Certainly good afternoon to everyone. It's a delightful day. We know that fall is coming when it's below 70 at night. And we've had a number of evenings that were very comforting. It'd be nice to have maybe, say, half an inch or an inch of rain every week and come up with that brown lawns and get them to slide away. I want to address a dilemma that we approach, that we see in the Bible from time to time. And to look at this dilemma, well, let's take a look at what Paul wrote in Romans 3:10. And Paul wrote in Romans 3:10, and it's very succinct, it's very blunt. And in Romans 3:10, he wrote, "There is none righteous, no, not one." Well, actually, the first part of the verse is, "As it is written, there's none righteous, no, not one." Well, where is it written? I looked up Psalms 14 and Ecclesiastes 7, and sure enough, it's written, there's no one righteous. Well, that's pretty emphatic, right? However, when we turn to 1 John 2:1, we read that Jesus Christ was righteous. In 1 John 2:1, "My little children, these things I write to you so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous." So, well, there's none righteous, no, not one. And yet Jesus Christ was righteous. And we do know that in order to be righteous, we have to have our righteousness. Things we do right. According to Matthew 5:20, we read that our righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees. Well, what kind of righteousness did the Pharisees have? They made it a habit to be very particular about every little thing, so that every little thing they wouldn't even get close to what they deemed to be unrighteous. Because what does it say in Matthew 5:20? "Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no wise enter the kingdom of heaven." And everybody looks, wow, you know, what a shock there. You know, they are so careful and so particular to do everything just so, that how could, that means really nobody is going to enter the kingdom. And yet we have this dilemma, because Paul clearly said that no one's righteous. And yet in Hebrews 11:4, what do we read? That the first person mentioned in the Bible as being righteous was Abel. Wait a minute. That sounds like a contradiction here. We have no one is righteous, and yet in Hebrews 4:11 it says, "By faith Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained a witness that he was righteous." Well, so now we have this dilemma that we're still looking at. And then we look at Genesis 7:1. And we read about somebody else called righteous, a man named Noah, in Genesis 7:1. "The Lord said to Noah, 'Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I've seen that you are righteous before me in this generation.'" Well, that's two right there. We have Abel and then Noah were labeled. And so we're still a little puzzled. How can there be no one righteous, and yet there's people that are listed in righteous? Not only was Noah called righteous, when Peter was preaching in 2 Peter 2, in verses 4 and 5, in verse 5 he says, Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness. That's what he was referring to. So not only was he called righteous, he was called a preacher of righteousness. Well, then we have this next personage in Genesis 15, 5 through 7. We have a man called Abraham who is considered righteous. And in Genesis 15, we read verse 6, "And he believed in the Lord," and he, meaning God, "accounted to him for righteousness." Ooh, so we've got this label continuing with a series of these people of old. Well, what is the measure of righteousness? And if we take a look in Romans 4:3, we do have a scale by which righteousness can be measured. For what does Romans chapter 4 and verse 3, "For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness." So it's a belief. in God is that measure of righteousness. We read that also what Paul wrote in Galatians 3:6. He wrote it again. Even as Abraham believed God, it was accounted to him for righteousness. So that's an emphasis. When you find that repeated in the Bible, this repetition is a form of emphasis. So belief in God is a measure of righteousness. And, of course, if we continue on in Genesis in 18, verses 23 to 25, we have this story there, and I won't recount it all now, but Abraham was bargaining with God to save the righteous. And he was bargaining over the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in Genesis 18, verse 23, Abraham came near and said, "Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" But the mindset that, well, maybe there are some people that are righteous. And then we also have at that same time, in 2 Peter 2:6, we're referring to the same period of time, the Apostle Peter referred to Abraham's nephew Lot as being righteous. In 2 Peter 2, starting in verse 6 and then going on to verse 7, "And delivered righteous Lot." Ooh. So now we've got a list of people who are righteous, and yet we still got that verse that says there's no one righteous, and yet we have a list of people that are listed, so we have this dilemma. Then we have this mindset that says, well, in Genesis 20, verses 3 and 4, it's not just people here. We have to ask the question, can a nation be righteous? In Genesis 20, in verses 3 and 4, and this was the challenge between Abimelech and Abraham, and verse 4, and Abimelech, who had taken Sarah because he saw this lovely woman and he was the ruler and thought he would take her, and Abimelech was worried because he was condemned to death. And verse 4, "But Abimelech had not come near to her," meaning Sarah. He said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also?" He was worried that a condemnation of him would carry forth to his entire nation. So here's a guy who wasn't particularly righteous, but he may have been right in that instance that he was innocently going in through something and did not want his nation destroyed. And then we know that it's possible to practice righteousness in Genesis 30, in verse 33. Now, this is the story of Jacob. And Jacob was dealing with his father-in-law Laban, and he was struggling in Genesis 30, starting in verse 32 through 34. And Jacob was trying to do the right thing, and his father kept changing up the wages for Jacob. For years, he would always switch things around to try to get the better of him. In verse 33, Genesis 30, 33, what did Jacob say? "My righteousness will answer for me in time to come." And it goes on to say, "when my wages," and so forth, with regard to that issue. So Jacob understood that righteousness would eventually win out. And then, of course, we go on to the next generation. And I'm not going to turn to Genesis 38. We've done the story and the story of Tamar here before about Judah. Had a dalliance with Tamar. And what did Judah say when he was caught? He said, "She has been more righteous than I." So there are degrees of righteousness. It's not just a yes or a no. It's degrees, and some actions are righteous. So this brings us to the idea that righteousness is an action, not just a state of being. If we take a look... we take a look at Deuteronomy 1. I know I'm throwing a lot of verses, but this issue of righteousness comes up because people can point to us too and say, well, you know, they're believers, or so they say, in the true God, but look at them. You know, clearly everybody here is a sinner, or they wouldn't be here asking God for redemption. Well, righteousness, looking at it, how do we determine it's an action? Look in Deuteronomy 1 and we take a look. verses 15 through 17. In fact, we, in verse 16, To the judges, hear the cases between your brethren and judge righteously between a man and his brother or stranger who is with him. Don't show partiality. There is a right way and there's a wrong way. There's a right, meaning righteous way, or a correct or a proper way to do things. What about a congregation? Can a congregation be righteous? We turn to Psalm 1. In Psalm 1, we read all the way down. In fact, we have this in our hymnal. And down to verse 5, therefore the ungodly shall not stand in right in judgment, nor the sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. So congregations can be considered righteous. And what does it say? That there are sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Ooh, a little more to the mix. Thankfully, God watches over the righteous people. And so we're getting to this point where righteousness being considered actions and not a state of being. In Psalm 34, the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open unto their cry. But if the congregation of the righteous are full of sinners, okay, then and we all are, every one, no, not one, has escaped from sin. God is still looking out for us. When the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, meaning those who are doing, wanting and trying to do the right thing. Verse 17 in Psalm 34, the righteous cry out, the Lord hears and delivers them out of their troubles. Verse 19, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. So we have this opportunity, even though as sinners, we can make right choices. We can pursue righteousness. And of course, in the model, or in the 23rd Psalm, we're in Psalms. If we go to 23rd Psalm, we read in verse 3, he, meaning the Lord is my shepherd, he leads us in the paths of righteousness. So God is leading us to establish more of a righteous relationship with our fellow man and with God. Now, we read earlier about Abimelech, about how he was concerned that his nation would be punished because he was doing something that he didn't realize what he was doing. Well, if we turn to Proverbs 29, verse 2, we can find out that a righteous ruler can affect a whole nation. So a ruler can be righteous. In Proverbs 29, verse 2, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. Hear any groaning lately? That's often the case when the wicked rule. If we take a look in Ezekiel 14, we have a list of men who were considered righteous. In Ezekiel 14:14, it lists these three: Noah, Daniel, and Job were accounted as righteous. Now, even so, they in particular couldn't save a nation. They could only ask that themselves be accepted by God. Ezekiel 14:14, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in the land, they could only present themselves before God by their righteousness. Well, that's meaning it's a level of individual responsibility. And of course, that follows up with, we reap what we sow. And we've heard of that one in Hosea 10. I'm not turning there, but that's a principle that the results of unrighteousness will also reap as well as the results of righteousness. Then we have, in Luke 1, we have an example in verses 5 through 7. Of the parents of John the Baptist. The parents of John the Baptist in Luke 1, starting in verse 5, in verse 6 it says, and it lists the parents of John the Baptist, verse 6, and they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and the ordinances of the Lord blameless. Well, this idea of righteousness then is the actions that we take as we follow God, not a state of being. So we can't, there's also the thought that we can't just appear righteous. And we all know that circumstance. I'm sure we've seen it in others and hopefully not so much in ourselves. But we have to be righteous on the inside as well as the appearance on the outside. Christ said, woe to the Pharisees in Matthew 25, especially down to verse 28. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. So there again, this idea of lawlessness is the opposite of righteousness, not following the commandments of God. So it's not just what's on the outside of what people see, it's also on what's inside that what God sees. Ultimately, then, it's not our righteousness that will afford salvation and eternal life, because salvation is a gift. We read that in Romans 5 and verse 17, the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one Jesus Christ. So that gift is offered to us. And through that gift of salvation, in 2 Timothy 4, the Apostle Paul writes, starting in verse 7, and he's facing death, but what does he say here? What's laid up for me, in 2 Timothy 4, verse 8, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day, not only to me only, but unto all them that also love his appearance. So now we have this, now we can start to reconcile the two statements. There's no one who is righteous, meaning that's that state of being where they've already accomplished it. Even Paul said, in the future, a crown of righteousness will be given to me. He didn't say, I'm righteous today. What would you think of somebody who comes up here and says, I'm righteous? You know, that would be pretty presumptuous. But we can be righteous in the sense that we're doing the right things. So it's an action. It's a process that we are moving forward. So this crown of righteousness is laid up for us as we just went through the Feast of Trumpets that would announce that time when those who could assume the crown of righteousness, who are the believers that would be changed at that time. Yes, Jesus Christ is the only one in the Bible who is considered righteousness as a state of being. In 1 John 2:1, he's called Jesus Christ the righteous, and he is our advocate with the Father because he was righteous. So then, in the bottom line, who is righteous? Well, righteousness is a journey. And that's where all of these people listed in the Bible were examples of righteousness. But it's also a destination. And that's what they were referring to when they refer to Jesus Christ as having made to that destination. So then, if we answer the question, who is righteous? Well, the answer is, well, you are, as you follow God's ways.